Welcome to the First Things podcast. On this episode, I'll talk with First Things editor Rusty Reno about the past, present, and future of American conservatism. Rusty comes not to praise Bill Buckley, but to bury him. Then I'll talk with literary editor Matthew Schmitz about three odd stories in the news this month. The inspiring or baffling case of the priest who married an ex-nun and so became an ex-priest and now is a priest again. Mike Pence's rules for a happy marriage. And from the wilds of New Jersey, the strange case of the professor who practiced radical inclusion and is now in prison for it. I'm Associate Editor Julia Yost. Thanks for joining us. I'm joined by Rusty Reno, who recently, in various venues, has put forward a thesis about the state of American political conservatism. He says that the terms of political debate have shifted. For a long time, freedom versus collectivism was the reigning dichotomy, minted in the pages of National Review. Conservatives championed the first term and were vindicated at home and abroad by the presidency of Ronald Reagan. Since the end of the Cold War, these terms have lost their purchase. Now, argues Rusty, the important opposition is nationalism versus globalism. The party that currently holds the White House is the party that accepted the new terms of debate and championed nationalism, however partially and in defiance of the think tank consensus. Rusty will now tell us how we got here and what will happen next. So Rusty, when and why did William F. Buckley's dichotomy become obsolete?
That's an interesting question. You know, it probably the dates we want to look at are Woodstock or maybe the Summer of Love. That's 1967, as I recall, San Francisco, Summer of Love. And then 1989, the fall of the Berlin Wall. So the Summer of Love is, you know, you have a view of American liberalism after the post-war era as it's the New Deal, it's the smart managerial set that promises to raise America up out of depression and ultimately organize our vast economic machine to win a global war. And that mentality of kind of collective or at least a kind of consolidated economic management with labor and management working together with government to promote America. You know, it was the boom years of the 50s. So the Democratic Party could plausibly be painted by Buckley as the collectivist party. Sort of socialism light would be. But by the time you get to 67, you know, these kids are embracing an awful lot of freedom in the revolutions, the cultural revolutions of the 1960s. And then you get to George McGovern in 1972. And even though they wanted to use the power of government to create equal opportunities for women, minorities, and so forth, eventually then using the government to create equal opportunity and freedom for gays and lesbians, so there's still a lot of government power involved here, but it's in the service of freedom in a more direct way. So it starts to break down. And then, of course, the collapse of the Soviet Union and socialism as a living force disappears from the historical scene.
So why is globalism now a threat and to whom? And why has neither party until 2016 addressed the needs of those threatened by globalism?
It's funny, you know, globalism kind of came on us without our noticing it. America built the international system after World War II, Bretton Woods Agreement 1944 to prepare for war's end, created the IMF and the World Bank and the kind of global economic, or the mechanisms for a global economic free trade regime. And then after the war, of course, the United Nations was seen as this important institution. It didn't live up to its promises. But nevertheless, the idea was that the United States needed to build strong international institutions to prevent another global war that would require us to be involved. And then it fairly quickly morphed into instruments by which we could challenge the Soviet Union on a global scale. But after 1989, you know, that that rationale fell by the wayside, and they kind of took on a life of their own, these institutions. And so we heard a lot of people tell us about how the world, Tom Friedman kind of being the classic apologist for this utopian world that's, you know, flat. The world is now going to be flat, and global integration is going to put an end to war, and it's going to bring prosperity. I mean, it's kind of a win-win. Everybody prospers. But certainly, I think 2008 and the financial crisis and the economic distress that it caused exposed in a way that had been hidden before, exposed more clearly the way in which globalism creates a very different class of winners and losers than the Cold War system did.
Both parties have been reaping the benefits of globalization, even while the citizenry as a whole hasn't necessarily.
Yes, I think if you look at both parties, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, they became increasingly oriented around rich people's concerns. And so obviously with the Republican Party, it's a little easier, you know, top marginal tax rates becoming the sort of be-all and end-all of electoral politics. And now, obviously, plausibly, people are arguing here that decreasing top marginal rates leads to greater economic activity, rising tide lifts all boats, et cetera, et cetera. That's the Reagan promise, which had some credibility to it in the 1980s, but it's become less and less credible in this moment. And then, of course, the Democratic Party, I think Gay writes, is kind of the ultimate rich person's issue. And identity politics is really about shoring up the moral authority of a largely white elite, a liberal elite. And as we saw with the Trump election, kind of like ordinary working people who couldn't be mobilized according to identity politics lines had fallen out of the equation for both parties. It's more shocking that it would in the Democratic Party because that's historically part of the base of the Democratic Party is the working man. Was part of the base of the Democratic Party. But that's been shifting for a long time. But so the Trump phenomenon kind of just was another stage in that shift. But he was the first one, he's the first politician I can see to really frame the big question is, are we going to have a globalist future or are we going to have a future oriented around national solidarity.
So why is national solidarity something helpful to people who are left behind by globalization? Why are we witnessing a reemergence of nationalism rather than something that's better described as class conflict?
Oh, right. No, that's a great question. Why not class conflict? It's never been a prominent part of American politics, partly because we have maybe it's our egalitarian ethos. We don't want to admit that we have strong class divisions in the United States. And that goes all the way up and down the economic ladder, that desire to see us kind of all kind of eating the same rations, even though it's obviously not true. But still, it's an important part of the American myth. But I think if we look at some of the symptoms, maybe we can think about this more clearly. Caterpillar Tractor Company moved, it's now announced it's moving its corporate headquarters from Peoria to Chicago. And the reason is that they can't attract top talent, so-called top talent, to some places backwards as Peoria. There's something wrong with a country when the leadership class doesn't want to actually live in the same place as most of the people in the country. And so we have the so-called creative class. Think about all the words we use to describe like what's driving our national project forward. It's the creative class. It's the innovators, entrepreneurs, startups. So we're talking about a really very small percent of the population that we believe is really, and that goes for both sides. You know, it's not just Republicans relishing you know, the robber barons as the real people driving things forward. No. Democratic Party's all about Silicon Valley, innovation. So we have a system where you want people who succeed in our society, who have positions of power, to see their achievements as in some way collective in nature, not individual. And one of the perverse effects of our meritocracy, which we instituted in order to make give people more equal access to elite institutions, you know, fancy universities, high-paying jobs, is that the meritocracy encourages you to believe that actually everything you have and achieve is yours.
There's no noblesse oblige.
There's no noblesse oblige, right. Or no sense that my achievements are in some sense due to the fact that I share with all my fellow citizens in a common system, so that my achievements are also their achievements. And then conversely, their suffering and failures are my sufferings and failures. And so there's that bond that joins people together. I remember when I was back in my Anglican days, my congregation was kind of a mix of black and white churches that had merged together. And one of the leaders of the congregation was a retired black man who had been in the Secret Service and was a sheriff, county sheriff, and all these sorts of jobs. And he wanted us to see Tuskegee Airmen about black pilots during World War II who were subjected to all this discrimination when they were training to fight for our country in North Carolina in 1944. And after the film, he was practically weeping, saying, how could we have done that? And to these men, which was a kind of a shocking thing. It was this black man who himself grew up under Jim Crow, using the we so that he had been in some sense implicated as an American in the very things that he had suffered under. That we is a very powerful force for social unity, and it creates accountability between the leadership, the leaders, and the led. And I think that that's really important for a democratic culture, which we do want talented, capable people to be in positions of leadership, but we want them to lead from within, so to speak, rather than from above.
So if nationalism versus globalism are the new terms of political debate, and the election of Donald Trump suggests that they are, do you think that the Republican Party is going to incorporate these new terms effectively? Will the Paul Ryans go along with it? And if the GOP does not sort of reconfigure itself along these lines, what then? I mean, what are the alternative scenarios here?
Yeah, these are very hard questions about the future. Hard to know. I think the easiest place to look is in foreign policy. A lot of misconceptions that to be anti-globalist is to be isolationist. And I think this is the wrong dichotomy. I think what we saw with the bombing in Syria by the Trump administration, it's very telling that unlike President Obama and President Bush and Bill Clinton before him, and for that matter, going all the way back to George H.W. Bush after the fall of the Berlin Wall, there was no show of trying to marshal a kind of international consensus to support bombing the airfield in Syria. He just did it.
And you could see how much that upset the managerial class. He's going it alone. There are no allies.
Yes, exactly.
And very disruptive.
So it's quite consistent. I think an American, a strong sort of inward turn to renew solidarity in our country is perfectly consistent with maintaining a very strong global role as leading and securing the international order. But it's a question of how it's done. How much confidence do we have that we can build up these international institutions to the point where they can supersede national sovereignty as the most reliable guarantor of order and justice? And the globalist thinks that's almost an inevitable future that we should be trying to work towards. The person who's more nationalist thinks that that's kind of utopian thinking, that's very dangerous, that the nation state remains the most reliable form of political accountability in the modern era, and that it still is the most reliable form of political accountability. So we see that going forward. Now, and I think that's easiest to see in the foreign policy front, because that's where the globalism is most obvious. Where it's less obvious and more thorny has to do with our embeddedness in a global economic system, where our weal and woe does depend upon that system. All of our weal and woes depend on that system. So how can we adjust and how can we rejigger the system to include more Americans in the prosperity that it generates? And that's a very thorny question. It's a combination of policy and a certain amount of rhetoric to at least acknowledge that it's a problem is something that I fear. You know, a lot of people want to go to education as the solvent, the cure-all. And everybody's going to get a degree from a prestigious university and become a partner at Goldman Sachs. Oh, I'm sorry, that's just not going to, this is a sort of pie-in-the-sky approach. Most people are not going to get college degrees and shouldn't get college degrees. In many ways, it would be a waste of resources. So it could be areas of training and vocational training and so on. I think Germany does a better job of this than the United States does. Europe in general does a better job of this than the United States does. So at many levels, we're going to have to revisit this question about how we, where everything from tax policy to trade policy to how we structure and think about our social welfare system has to be rethought in terms of how we renew, to renew the economic stability and prosperity of the middle class, American middle class.
Is it possible that the Democrats will beat the Republicans to
sure,
it?
Of course, yes. I mean, their great impediment is their investment in identity politics,
right,
which I think emerged precisely in order to distract people from the real problem of our society, which is the declining stability of middle-class American life and their increasingly tenuous cultural as well as economic situation.
Identity politics is also something that instructs people that their primary allegiance is not to the nation. I mean, it need not be to the nation, but it gives them something else to attach themselves to, some identity that is not the nation.
I think it's a sub-political venture. I mean, I think we've got two things going on in our politics. There are certain things where we just say, well, this is out of our hands. It's a human rights question, or it's the international market won't tolerate X, Y, or Z. So if you're a liberal, you tend to want to say these international institutions trump political liberation. And if you're on the right, you tend to say, well, the global marketplace overrides what can be done politically. I mean, I cannot tell you how many conversations I have with people who say, you know, Donald Trump cannot bring those jobs back. Those jobs are not coming back. The global economic system has fundamentally changed the economic conditions of America. And I think surely you have to be realistic about the conditions of our political life, but it's striking when the rhetoric coming from the right is, hey, something has transcended politics. We just don't have any political choices we can make anymore. We just have to accept the global system as fate. And I think that's just deadly for any democratic culture, to tell people they have no political choices about the things that matter to them most. And then identity politics is kind of sub-political. It tells people that, hey, you know, it's really not kind of these classic questions about how we organize the polis that matter. It really has to do with your identity to some group or some identity that is, I mean, I can see African Americans and to some extent Hispanic immigrants, there's something real about their communities, but the gay community, I mean, wow, talk about something that you can kind of slide in and out of according to its convenience to you while you're at the same time a banker or a lawyer or a doctor. And so I think in both cases, both parties face real headwinds to be able to re-engage politics in what I think is, at least in the West more broadly with populism in Europe, as well as the United States, the strong messages that we're getting from the polls are that voters don't like the global system as it currently is, and they want to renew the national covenant.
So if I'm working at National Review and I'm thinking we need to mint a new dichotomy, give up freedom versus collectivism, take up nationalism versus globalism, one of my concerns about that would of course be that unlike freedom, nationalism is not obviously or immediately the more appealing term of that dichotomy, at least for a lot of people. Certain wars have given it a bad name. And for a lot of people, globalism may still seem like a synonym for freedom.
I think it's possible to cast globalism in a negative light. I think people intuitively sense the way in which they get disenfranchised as sort of power becomes globalized and only really accessible to the global elite. So I do think you can do that, but I agree, nationalism, I think that conservatives need to think through how globalism undermines self-government and think about things in terms of sovereignty and self-government,
yeah.
which is freedom. I mean, political freedom is self-government. And so I think it's possible to look at globalism as having some of the features that Buckley worried about in collectivism, and look at national sovereignty, renewing the national covenant. These are terms I like better than nationalism, and see that as renewing the foundations for a free society. So I think it's, I don't think, you know, National Review or movement conservatives need to sort of toss out what they've learned, what we've learned over the last three or four generations since 1945, which I think is when modern American conservatism really comes into its own. I don't think we need to toss aside those kind of classic texts and important arguments, but they need to be updated. The collapse of the Soviet Union, a certain kind of freedom triumphed in that, but it bred its own kinds of bondages and unfreedom.
What should Christians think about this shift in our political debates?
I think first things, as a journal that tries to speak to public matters from a religious foundation, I think that we should always be very anxious about utopianisms in politics. And there's no question that globalism is a kind of utopianism. And it's a way to organize public life in such a, you know, we organize public life in such a way that we can somehow cure the problem of original sin. And I think globalism especially, there's a universalism abroad. I mean, during the political campaign of the last season, I was very struck when I talked to my friends how few really thought that national borders were morally defensible. They say practically you gotta have them, but they weren't morally defensible. I was really very taken by that. That's really kind of a shocking, and that was broadly true. I mean, not just my progressive friends. And it's a sign that our moral imaginations have been corroded by this utopian view, and that it impoverishes our political imaginations to think that we can solve or even really ameliorate our sort of the struggle for a just society by putting in place the right sort of market conditions. I mean, one of the features of modern political life has been the effort to have justice without virtue. And part of that is to put the right system in place. So there's a strong impulse towards, and that's the source of ideology. You know, if greed creates oppression in economics, then we have to get rid of private property, so we'll get rid of that. If national pride and a deep sense of loyalty to one's homeland creates the conditions for war, well, we have to get rid of that. So there's a way in which we want to sort of do surgery on human nature and cut out some piece of human nature in order to ensure, guarantee a better future. I think this is very much part of the globalist temptation of our time that we need to resist.
I'm joined by Matthew Schmitz to discuss a few odd stories that have been in the news of late. First, a story out of the Archdiocese of Boston. Frank Daly was ordained a priest in 1967. A few years later, he fell in love with an ex-nun. He asked to be laicized so that he could marry her. The church denied him this, so in 1978 he went AWOL and married her in a civil ceremony. 3 years later, the church relented, officially laicized him, and granted them a church wedding. Daly enjoyed many years of marriage, a couple of kids, and a career as an ethics consultant for a defense contractor. In 2015, he became a widower. He then thought, why not become a priest again? Church officials made a pretty extraordinary exception for him, and now, at 74, Father Daly is not just a priest, but soon to be a pastor in a liberal region of the Boston Archdiocese. He's also the subject of a glowing profile in the Boston Globe, which apparently the Archdiocese sent in an email blast to all its priests, recommending this as an inspiring story. Matthew, what's wrong with this picture?
One need not have any objection to marriage or to the priesthood or even some kind of messy transit between them to find something strange in the sentimental presentation of this story. There's a tendency in our culture, I think, to celebrate people who have chosen experience over innocence, people who have been in many varied states of life over those who have committed to only one. And so we almost want to accord a kind of prestige, maybe even heroism, to a man who, say, has been married before being a priest. Now, the 60s were a wild time to become a priest of the Catholic Church. Seminarians were being told that in just a few years they'd be allowed to get married. The disorientation was pervasive. But some men who were ordained at that time stayed in the priesthood. They honored their vows. They suffered in silence. They did not enjoy the consolations of children or the rewards of a career. Instead, they just went home alone to a rectory each night. And the Boston Globe has not run glowing profiles on those men. Instead, as a rule, they've been depicted as strange fellows who probably don't understand marriage and may even have a strange or perverse relationship to children. So the depiction of this man as a kind of hero shows our desire to take moral pressure out of life, to offer not the rewards of sacrifices made and heroism rewarded, but instead to reassure everyone that choices aren't binding, and a refusal to make hard sacrifices won't preclude the rewards that usually come with them. Now, the most notable thing about this guy is that he's, you know, not fictional. So when I first read about him, I thought he was probably a villain from a Matthew Walther novel. To leave the priesthood, marry an ex-nun, and then consult on ethics for a company that sells advanced weapons systems to be used by the allies of American Imperium. Anyway, so I guess he is real. And though I'm sure he's a fine man, I think the celebration of his story, both by the Globe and by the Boston Archdiocese, with the direct involvement, I understand, of Pope Francis in moving this case forward, shows the broad disorientation of our leaders.
So let's consider this from the perspective of the church officials who pushed through this exception. Why did they reinstate Frank Daly? Why are they so proud of themselves for doing it, as they appear to be? At 74 years old, Father Daly isn't doing that much to help the Archdiocese meet its personnel needs. I mean, he's not giving a lifetime of service. And yet it seems the Archdiocese moved heaven and earth to get this exception through. And Rome was strangely compliant with it, strikingly compliant. Clearly the value of his exceptional arrangement is symbolic rather than practical. So what does it symbolize? What are church leaders trying to signal by doing this?
Our leaders are confused, and so the symbol indicates that confusion. Do we want to, say, have married priests? Possibly, though possibly not. We have mixed signals from the Vatican on that point. Do we want to say that making lifelong sacrifices is the way to holiness? Well, yes, we do. But on the other hand, leaving one spouse and taking up with another doesn't keep one from communion. So there's this kind of broad disorientation in Rome, a desire to have one's cake and eat it too. Very understandable desire, and I think that's behind this, a sort of attempt to create a counterfeit mercy that really leads only to confusion.
Right. I'm also struck by how a move like this seems to elevate sentimentality over sacramentality in a way that seems to comport very nicely with Amoris Laetitia. Father Daly's extreme disobedience in leaving the priesthood without a dispensation.
I believe he would have incurred automatic excommunication by his acts.
Right, and getting a civil marriage that only later, through an act of mercy or just indifference by the church, then was complemented with a church wedding. This is a pattern of behavior that suggests that Catholic moral teaching, Catholic sacramental marriage, isn't that important. Father Daly and his wife seemed to have felt that a church wedding would be good. You know, they got it when it was offered to them, but they were also willing to proceed without it. And so this guy is now a priest. Well, he seems a perfect priest for the Francis era.
All of us can be, you know, rebels against grace and act against the church's teaching. What's necessary, though, is that the people charged with that teaching continue mercifully, yes, but also faithfully to proclaim it, and that they proclaim it in a way that encourages those of us who may have trouble following it. I want examples to be held up by Rome that help me live a life of, if not moral heroism, at least bare decency. I don't need the deflation of well-publicized cases where people made a muck of things and then were celebrated for it.
Right, not celebrated for their repentance and reforming, but rather for the fact that they got to have it both ways and never were laid
low. So that's how this layman reads that story. You know, obviously Father Daly's desire to be a priest is not a dishonorable one in itself, but the celebration of this case by the press, and also, I should say, by the Archdiocese of Boston, it disorients me further instead of giving me clear directions that help me hasten my steps.
Our second story is about Vice President Mike Pence. We learn that Pence and his wife Karen long ago established some ground rules for protecting their marriage. Whenever Pence has a business dinner with a woman, Karen will be present. When alcohol is served at an event, Pence will not imbibe unless Karen is with him. When Pence has to stay late at the office, he must have only a male assistant with him. When these rules were reported in a Washington Post profile of Karen Pence, ridicule and scandal ensued. As one writer put it in the Daily Beast, "It's funny, ha-ha, to imagine a 57-year-old man relating to women in the way a second grader afraid of cooties relates to girls. It's funny, uh-oh, to reflect on how somebody unwilling to spend time around women has spent so much time trying to legislate away women's access to health care, e.g. by voting to defund Planned Parenthood." So Mike Pence apparently views women as demonic, and we can be either horrified or amused, or both. Matthew, your thoughts?
Women are demonic, is my view, but I don't think that is Pence's view. The Daily Beast writer's ridicule of Pence strikes me as really incredible. This isn't the only thing for which Pence has been ridiculed. Probably the other aspect of him that drew the most scorn over the last year was the fact that he wrote some op-eds years back saying that smoking doesn't kill. Yeah, lots of people smoke who don't die. Japan has the highest rate of smoking in the world and also a very high life expectancy, yada yada. Now, of course, filling your lungs with brackish air isn't very good for you, but Mike Pence, maybe he got lots of loot from the tobacco lobby, but for whatever reason, he was saying that smoking isn't the worst possible thing. There's not a vast moral gulf between the righteous non-smokers and the unrighteous smokers. Yet in our society, for some good reasons, we make lots of distinctions between them. There are smoking and non-smoking sections. Actually, for the most part, there are no longer smoking sections. But you know, I grew up with having them in restaurants. If you went to the Cracker Barrel or Village Inn, there'd be the smoking section. You know, so there's kind of recognition that the choices we make, the influences to which we expose ourselves, can have personal consequences and also public consequences. Now, I view Mike Pence's policies on women as basically being in accord with, you know, reflecting the same sort of intuition as those who try not to be around smokers or something. They realize that certain situations can be dangerous and we have to carefully regulate ourselves when we're in those situations, the same way that someone might want to be very careful about alcohol. So probably this is in part a war between competing moralisms. You know, one moralism that views sex as very dangerous, and another moralism that views any offense against diversity and equality as very dangerous. And in that war, I side with Pence. You know, we hear constantly stories of politicians who've got themselves wounded while hiking Appalachian trails. And seems to me Pence and his wife are very wise to be careful about it. Now, maybe another politician's foible would involve young men and not women, and he would have good reason to be careful about that and only have female assistants around the office. But the notion that we should be blithe about these things as a way of kind of brandishing our wokeness, it's just madness. Men aren't women. And Pence is obviously, for all of his faults of which he seems to be aware, he seems to be convinced that he might slip and fall. For all his faults, this policy, I think, indicates he's a decent man.
You mentioned competing moralisms. I think another way of framing that is to say that there's one moralism that is formal and codified, and there's another kind of moralism that is informal, adaptive, contingent, more about principles with mutable applications than about articulated rules.
Right, so in every army, you have special ops and grunts. The grunts need to stay in line and follow orders. If your special ops people all stood in a line and only followed orders, well, you wouldn't be able to double tap Osama. So increasingly we want a society that's created only for the Green Berets. For example, this is what some church leaders want today. They want everyone to be kind of spiritual master, and that means downplaying the rules that help the very simple get along. And you know, these sort of strict rules like Pence has are designed preeminently for helping people who aren't masters and who need a little more guidance. So part of this is probably a class war. There's an objection to having someone who's so low class and vulgar as to need these rules, an objection to having him living in the Naval Observatory. We would rather that our leaders be splendidly free of such lower class restraints. But certainly Pence's own brand of evangelical Christianity tends to democratize those sorts of rules. It wants to make everyone into a blue ribbon man or teetotaler. It wants everyone to be a sort of promise keeper, to kind of have, you know, adopt these formal rules. Something very American in that, and I think really very admirable.
Finally, there's the Anna Stubblefield case out of New Jersey. In 2015, Anna Stubblefield, a philosophy professor at Rutgers University in Newark, was convicted of aggravated sexual assault against a 33-year-old man with severe cerebral palsy and the mental capacity of a toddler. Anna had been working with the man, known to us as DJ, using a controversial technique called facilitated communication. She claimed that, with her support, DJ had learned to express himself. He was revealing a normal adult intelligence, which had been concealed for years by his physical impairments. Her claim is contestable, to say the least. Anna, a white academic who specializes in Black studies and disability studies, fell in love with DJ, who is both Black and disabled. She had three sexual encounters with him and planned to leave her husband and children for him. She calls this radical inclusion. The state of New Jersey calls it aggravated sexual assault. Anna received a sentence of 12 years in prison, 10 without the possibility of parole. Her story is back in the news this month because her appeal is working its way through the courts, and because Peter Singer, of all people, has co-authored a New York Times op-ed in her defense. Matthew, your thoughts?
The thing that typifies all of Stubblefield's various actions in this protracted saga is the desire for what's called radical inclusion, making those who are marginal, so the radically disabled, especially the poor black radically disabled people, making them part of the moral community. Facilitated communication is this Ouija board method where you're kind of guiding the arm or the hand of the person under the supposition that you're actually communicating with the interior person. You're including them in our verbal conversations. This is actually hooey, but that's the conceit. And again, Anna Stubblefield, liberal academic who wrote a lot about race and was involved in the whole kind of diversity racket in academia, sought to include people who were marginalized, you know, kind of social, political, racial terms. An admirable impulse. But in DJ's case, all of this kind of came together in the idea that ultimately the most profound form of inclusion in society has to be intimate, sexual. Under our current public philosophy, you know, if one can't have sex, you know, one really isn't fully human. This is, you know, partly why we have weird agonies about the sexualization of children. We've sort of identified sex as kind of fully human, the kind of fullest expression of our humanity. So, you know, we at once want to include children in that, but are sort of fearful of the prejudices that make us feel that way. And in this case, her firm belief that DJ was human, that he really could communicate with us, this desire actually led her to rape him.
Another irony, I think, is that facilitated communication, which is, it's advocated by these disability rights advocates, it's ironically very ableist, right? Because it's...
So what is ableism?
So ableism is, a prejudice in favor of people who are normally abled, who have, you know, ordinary human capacities, ordinary or above average human capacities. So it's a bias against the disabled. But facilitated communication exhibits precisely that bias because it's only ready to include people who can be discovered underneath their physical impairments to be cognitively able.
So a kind of soft materialism is a very dangerous sort of public philosophy. If one affirms the dignity of every soul, the image of God impressed on each human, no matter how disabled or disfigured he may be, one is able to recognize someone who has nil mental capacity as human as anyone else, because it's not about the mental capacity, it's not about the ability to participate in conversations, say, let alone physical intercourse. It's really just about their membership in the human species, and by virtue of that membership, their bearing of the image of God. That's the Christian basis of what we might call radical inclusion. You know, an inclusion in God's act of creation and also in his promise of redemption, one hopes. If one can't rely on those notions, if one cannot recognize a human soul, one's going to be forced to be an ableist in some sense. It has to come down to our physical capacities. And this is something that Singer admirably has always recognized. Singer's, you know, not only dreadful, but rather boring, yet he admirably and hopefully follows conclusions that a lot of people hold to their logical end. If we don't think that every life is worthy of protection, if we have to assign it value somehow through its ability, through its approximation to an ideal, then it really does make sense to not only allow abortion, but also infanticide or murder of the disabled. And Peter Singer, of course, thinks that Anna Stubblefield could rape this man, DJ. He also thinks, frankly, that we can kill DJ. He doesn't think there's anything morally objectionable about it because DJ has the same ability to write a peer-reviewed paper as a cucumber would. But that doesn't happen to make him any less human. There's a great deal of understandable sentimentality surrounding our discourse when it comes to disability. We want to describe people as differently abled. We also want to use ableism as if it weren't better to have more ability. I mean, in fact, it is better to have more ability, But crucially, that's not the basis of our dignity, and it can't be the basis of on which we strip someone of their right to be considered fully and finally human.
In addition to being ableist, facilitated communication, I think, is also often classist. Subjects of facilitated communication are often found to be not just of normal IQ, but of high IQ. And through their facilitators, they compose prose poems and reveal elite cultural tastes. Anna provides us with a great example of this. She endowed DJ, who is from a working class black background, with certain bourgeois class markers, such as a dislike of gospel music and a liking for the wine label Fat Bastard.
Yeah, just some kind of bougie wine label. And DJ, who goes to church every Sunday with his family and does the little Stevie Wonder dance to gospel music, suddenly, according to his facilitated communicator, doesn't care for gospel music. I think about my drama professor, who was a very flamboyant man and liked to say that inside of every gay man there was a black woman waiting to burst out. Not politically correct, but this was, 2004 or 2008, and people could still say things like that on campus. With facilitated communication, it's more like, inside of every, poor black disabled man, there's a bougie white woman waiting to burst out. That's kind of what Anna Stubblefield did to DJ. There was such a telling remark made by DJ's brother in a long story on this in the New York Times. He said that he began to doubt facilitated communication when he noticed that DJ was, suddenly had these weird tastes, Fat Bastard wine, not liking gospel music. And he said, I don't think DJ likes wine, because whenever we're at church and have communion, this being the church where he's doing the Stevie Wonder gospel dance, he doesn't really take to the wine. And that made me think about what the basis is for a Christian's idea of radical inclusion. Certainly that has its fullest expression in the Eucharist, and it's connected not with our own abilities so much as it is with God's work for us. These poor folk from the inner city, DJ's family, have available to them resources for understanding DJ as human that a liberal academic like Anna simply does not have. And that's why Anna ended up raping him, and his family ended up defending him.
That's all for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to my colleagues, Rusty Reno and Matthew Schmitz. Thanks to Anna Stubblefield for her wine recommendations, and to Matthew Walther for not authoring the career of Father Frank Daly. And thank you, listeners. Thank you.